Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.
This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
Top-notch, value-added, hot-off-the-presses news.
Bloomberg puts out thousands of news stories a day, but some really stick with you.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories, powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best for November 7th, 2016. Americans go to the polls tomorrow to elect a new president. Carl Weinberg is chief economist at High Frequency Economics.
The worst possible outcome of all of this is we get to Wednesday and we don't have an answer, and we get to Thursday and we don't have an answer, and we have a protracted dispute over what the result actually is. That's a possible outcome, too. That's not part of any of the polls.
Plus, we talked to former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan about the Fed and the economy.
Central bankers are no better than an average good economist in forecasting the economy. As a consequence of that, we are limited in our projections of what policy is apt to be by the limits of our knowledge.
And the CEO of discount airline Ryanair weighs in on Brexit.
What worries me about Brexit is the UK government clearly has no idea what it's doing. It has no agenda in terms of negotiations.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. Are your returns dragged down by high transaction costs? Well, trade up to Interactive Brokers, where our lower costs can help you maximize your returns. Visit ibkr.com/save more for more information. It is election eve, and voters tomorrow will decide on who will be the next president of the United States. Now, we got the opinion of several Wall Street watchers on what it will mean for the markets and the economy. So first, we'll start with RBC Capital Chief U.S. Market Strategist Jonathan Golub and High Frequency Chief Economist Carl Weinberg, who spoke with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Francine Lacroix on Bloomberg Surveillance.
Fiscal policy, is that what we understand the most by two candidates? Unclear. So Hillary Clinton put a number on how much she wants to spend. What about Donald Trump?
Yeah, well, we don't really have a lot of details from Donald Trump, so it's hard to analyze his program. Clearly, there'll be big tax cuts. There'll be a run-up in the deficit. The so-called bipartisan non-political groups have put it together and figured that there'll be probably about a 2% of GDP deficit that comes out of that. On the Clinton side, we have a package of spending increases and tax increases at the same time. That's a balanced budget multiplier. Should be good for growth, but there's the risk that Congress might pass one part of it, say the spending, and not the other. So we got to see what happens in Congress.
Jonathan, we haven't really talked about the composition of Congress, but actually, do you automatically assume that stocks go up if it's a Clinton win, a clear win, and stocks go down Wednesday morning if Trump wins?
Well, you raise this point about the composition of Congress.
Right.
I think that the market would not be happy if you had an all Democratic sweep. I think that while we don't, you know, say we don't like gridlock, at the end of the day, I think Wall Street does not want to see a more left-leaning, full, all-out agenda in Washington. So what they probably would like to see is the Senate go Democrat, the presidency go Democrats, and Republicans keep the House.
Can I make money? Can I make money off this market? I mean, when I look at the Dow and I look at the range bound we've been in through the election process, do you just presume a breakout range to higher prices, whomever's elected?
Well, I do, and probably have, you know, we're in this conversation, we're making the assumption that the election is going to be the driver of what stock markets do, and that's not going to be the case. You know, right now, if you look at what the market's telling you is that they're happier to see a Clinton win. The odds went up after the Comey memo, and so you get a tiny relief rally. But you know, past that, what we have is an economy, as Carl said, that's growing very modestly. But we are seeing something very interesting, that stock multiples, PEs, are going up,
right,
even though earnings are really tepid. And I think that's going to be the story over
the
next couple of years.
What is the why there? That's precisely right. What is the why?
The why is that the companies are returning a huge amount of cash back to shareholders. The yield on the S&P, if you add dividends and buybacks, is 4.7%. And investors are looking at that compared to alternatives in bonds, and they're still pushing stock valuations higher. And equity investors are really uncomfortable with this divergence between a really uncomfortably tepid economy and stock multiples, which keep grinding higher.
That was Jonathan Golub from RBC Capital Markets and Carl Weinberg from High Frequency Economics. And later on, Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Francine Lacroix also spoke with Wendy Schiller, a political science professor at Brown University.
I look at turnout of the African-American vote, turnout of Latinos, and turnout of Asians as well as being decisive. Give us nuance on that.
Well, I mean, even in Florida alone, right, a third, apparently more than a third of the people who voted early already in the Latino community did not vote in 2012. Early voting in the Latino community has surpassed even all turnout in 2012. What you're seeing is an enormous activation, a mobilization of the Latino community, particularly in Florida. Latino nationwide, 48% turnout for presidential elections. If you get to 51, 52, 53%, what's important here is this isn't states that have GOP congressmen. It's not just about the national election. It's about changing the nature of the constituency pressure on the GOP in the House in particular. That, to me, might be the story coming out of 2016.
Is there a mystery to Asian turnout? Is this the first election where there's an Asian voice to our electorate?
Well, yeah, what's interesting now is the Census Bureau, you know, traditionally 30 years ago, you would have thought of Asian as perhaps Korean, Japanese, Chinese, but South Asians, which are a very large group, including Indians, Pakistanis, et cetera, Indonesians, South Asians are now in that category. And South Asians usually emigrated on work visas. They tend to be better educated. So what happens now is that voting block has changed. It's gotten bigger. It's also represented by a different diversity of educational level, which get people out the door and to vote. So that's another dynamic, and that group is supposed to grow, you know, as large as Latinos over the next 30 years. So if that voting bloc, which has been mixed politically, goes over to the Democrats and stays there, that's another way in which the Democrats, particularly in the Southeast and the Southwest, can build up competition against the GOP.
That was Brown University professor Wendy Schiller speaking with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Francine Lacroix. Coming up, how will a new president affect the Pentagon budget? We speak with retired Navy Admiral James Tavridis next. You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg. Bloomberg Best is brought to you by the accountants and advisors at Eisner Amper. Your personal asset allocation strategy has many critical components. Do you have a good idea of what they are? Ask the wealth advisors at Eisner Amper, eisneramper.com/asset allocation. How much, if any, will the next president affect the military budget? Retired Navy Admiral James Tavridis, who is currently the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, spoke with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and David Gura for more on how the next administration could impact policy.
Does a president affect the spending of the Pentagon, or is a Pentagon such its own thing that there's the delusion that defense affects it, but it's really just keeps going by itself?
Well, terrific question, Tom, and, you know, kind of harkens back to Eisenhower's warnings about the military-industrial complex. I think the answer is somewhere in the middle, which is to say that probably 65-70% of the Pentagon's budget is baked in. It's personnel costs, it's long-term contracts. That remaining 30-35%, however, is discretionary within the Pentagon, and the administration and the president have great influence over it.
Are you satisfied with the degree to which the candidates have been talking about foreign policy during this election? I would say they've talked about it a lot. I don't know how much in what detail, if that's been satisfying. But how about you? What's your sense of how they've been talking about it?
I think, like most Americans, I'd say the unfortunate character of this election is that we spent, seems to me, about 60% of the time on ephemeral issues, kind of the personalities of the candidates, sharp elbows, denigrating comments, and only, to my ear, about 40% of the time on the issues, and of that, maybe 20% on foreign policy. So, no, I don't think we've talked enough about foreign policy.
Well, I think we can all agree on that. Admiral, the morning after, or I guess 5 days after, or 20 days after, certainly by January 20, whatever, a president is briefed. How do guys like you, with all that brass in your chest, how do you brief a president, either experienced like Secretary Clinton or someone new at the job like President Trump?
I think the active duty admirals and generals will be called over early and often, Tom, frankly, because I think the new president is going to be challenged early and often, starting from Moscow. So you take into account the president's level of experience and expertise. You adjust the briefings. We are pretty good at this, and we can deal with candidates who come into office with vast knowledge and are veterans themselves, and we deal with candidates who have zero experience. So we know how to do this.
I think back on the conference you had at Tufts just a couple weeks ago, our colleague Michael McKee was there speaking to you then. You've written that the rest of Europe and the United States need to stand with Greece during this difficult period. President Obama has announced one of his last trips abroad, if not his last trip abroad as president, will be to Greece. With all of your experience and knowledge of that country, what do you hope that he does there? What do you hope that he says?
Well, I think hope is the key word. What has really held the Greeks back in a psychological sense, let's leave aside the obvious challenges in the economy, but psychologically, the people feel very beaten down. They feel as though they're in this kind of hot corner of Europe on the front line to the Syrian war, got a restive Turkey across the Aegean, and they feel as though the rest of the West has kind of let them drift away a little bit. So simply by coming to Athens and speaking to the people, he'll energize the Greek people. And I'm a big believer that the human capital in Greece is going to make that country succeed.
Admiral, back to the new president. How staffed, I'm usually saying this as an amateur, how staffed is our army? How staffed is our Navy? Remember when we talked about aircraft carriers out to sea with not enough personnel on board? Are we properly budgeted now to run our military?
I think we have roughly the right amount of money coming into the department, Tom, but I would argue we need to reallocate it somewhat. We probably need small incremental increases, but we need more money in cyber defense. We need more money in unmanned vehicles. We need more money in special forces. We need to do a renovation of our nuclear triad. Those are the big ticket items where I think the money needs to go.
Okay.
In terms of personnel, we're pretty strong, but if the economy does pick up post-election, that competition for bright young men and women will hurt us in that dimension.
That was retired Navy Admiral James Stavridis and currently Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, speaking with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and David Gura. Coming up, we talk the impact of Brexit and low oil prices on the airline industry with the CEO of low-cost European carrier Ryanair. You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on the millennial generation with Bloomberg's Zara Kessler.
The situation.
Millennials, you might think of it as those born about 1981 to 2000. There's no consensus exactly how to define them, but if you use that framework, it's people about 16 to 35 years old this year. And so that's a lot of what you might currently think of as kind of young adults. And if you're using that 1981 to 2000 definition, you're looking at about 89 million millennials in the U.S., and that makes them the country's largest living generation.
The background.
So if you jump back, there's baby boomers, and many of those are parents of millennials, actually, and they're born 1946 to 1964. So that puts Generation X, which follows them in between the baby boomers and millennials.
The argument.
So they're tremendously attractive as a voting bloc. They're currently neck and neck with baby boomers as the biggest generational share of voting age U.S. citizens, according to Pew. And, you know, these are the future voters and taxpayers and, you know, you name it, of the country. So getting young people and getting millennials on your side is a good thing.
For more on millennials or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.
You're listening. listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter. Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, N.A., FDIC. Ryanair Holdings shares rose more than 5% today after the Dublin-based low-cost carrier announced plans to buy back as much as $600 million of stock after record passenger numbers over the summer helped second-quarter profit beat analyst estimates. Chief Executive Michael O'Leary spoke earlier with Bloomberg Television's Anna Edwards and Youssef Gamal Eldin.
It's a tough environment out there. We're doing very well. We're growing very strongly, but on the back of lower fares. So it's a very bearish market. Customers are benefiting from much lower airfares. They're booking in bigger numbers. Our forward bookings are strong. The business continues to deliver, and we've announced another share buyback this morning. So, you know, I think these are tough times, but Ryanair is doing very well in tough times as people trade down to lower fares.
Talk to me a little bit more about what you're doing in terms of your hedge and your sterling forecast as well for 2017.
Yeah, we've been very conservative. I mean, we're fully hedged on oil, well, almost fully hedged on oil out to March 18 now. $59 a barrel in the current year, falling to $49 a barrel next year in FY, or for to March 18. We've been hit by sterling, so we've hedged out the sterling risk on sales out to the end of this fiscal year, March 17. So we've eliminated taking that off the table. So, you know, we're pretty conservative in the way the airline is run. Unit costs are falling. I think the big message for us with Sharon is that while fares are down 10 percentage points, unit costs are also down 10 points. And we expect that to continue because we've locked away cheaper oil for the next 18 months.
Tell us about the rationale around that hedging, because it's not something, currency hedging is not something that you do all the time, is it, at Ryanair? But you've decided to do that this time around. I mean, the costs, clearly, you don't think they're prohibitive then this time.
Well, we generally are very, we do a lot of currency hedging on CapEx. So we have aircraft orders out to March 19. We've completely hedged the dollar on that. We've taken away the dollar risk about just over 130. At 130, so we're in very good shape there. We tend not to hedge our sterling exposure. We have a slight surplus sterling short dollar, but, you know, given the extraordinary moves in sterling post-Brexit, we thought it was sensible at least to take that risk off the table to the end of this fiscal year. We look into a winter where, I mean, as far as we can see, fares will keep falling. That should be good for demand, certainly strong load factors. We're 2% stronger booked into the winter period than we were this time last year. So, you know, I think we'll continue to trade very strongly. Very good news for customers, but shareholders will have to wait a little for returns.
As you watch how this whole Brexit process is being managed, how is that affecting your planning? I mean, last time around, we had you on the set. You said, you know, chaos would ensue. It needs to be managed correctly. You, as a business owner, a business leader, you would pull out gradually and push more into Europe. Well, where are you at with that process?
Well, I mean, we've never said we'd pull out, but what we've said is we'd pivot the growth away from the UK. We had planned to grow in the UK, our capacity in the UK in 2017 by 12%. We've now cut that by more than 50%. We'll only grow by about 5% next year. So there's real meaningful decisions. The UK is losing out on, you know, significant growth. That growth is being pivoted into markets like Germany, Poland, Italy and Spain, where frankly the costs are lower and we at least have political certainty. And what worries me about Brexit is the UK government clearly has no idea what it's doing. It has no agenda in terms of negotiations. The Europeans have been quite consistent. You can have single market access, but you pay and you obey. And really, I think I hope there'll be an enormous fudge and dither here for the next 2 years. But I'm really pessimistic because I don't think Mrs. May or any of her ministers have any idea what the hell they're doing.
Maybe Carlos Ghosn knows what the UK government is up to. When you watch that whole story around the investment in the car sector in the UK, do you think, hang on a second, aviation wants a piece of that? If I've got a list of demands, these are my demands, Theresa May, and to invest more in the UK, this is what I need?
Frankly, I wouldn't waste too much time on it. Look, I mean, I think what Nissan do, Nissan do. I mean, if the UK does leave the European Union, Nissan will sell a lot more cars because, you know, European cars have become so expensive. And I think the UK electorate were lied to in the referendum. They were told we could leave the European Union, but you could stay in the single market and still have all the benefits. It's now becoming increasingly clear that's not the case. It isn't true. But the agenda will be set by the Europeans. I mean, what worries me is Mrs. May has committed to filing the Article 50 in March, and then there is a two-year guillotine. And there's no kind of incentive on the Europeans to help her. There's no incentive on the Europeans to even sit down and negotiate with her. It was simply the UK would run out of road in 2 years.
That was Ryanair Chief Executive Michael O'Leary speaking earlier on Bloomberg Television. Up next, a conversation with former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
With the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report, I'm Michael Barr. If you want an example of China's changing economy and maybe the heavy hand of state guidance, look at skiing. Northeast China government officials are touring cities in the south to promote ski vacations. They're part of a headlong push to get 300 million Chinese skiers on the slopes by the time Beijing hosts the 2022 Winter Olympics. Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban has revoked the season media credentials of two Dallas-area ESPN writers, Mark Stein and Tim McMahon. The story in Business Insider says that's according to multiple reports. Tim Cato of Mavs Moneyball says Cuban made the decision because he was upset over McMahon's new role with ESPN this season. For the past 7 years, McMahon had covered the Mavericks beat full-time. This season, McMahon has transitioned to writing more broadly about the NBA on a national level. Stein has been a national NBA writer for years. And that's a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Marks Paneth LLP, ranked among the top three forensic accounting firms in New York by the New York Law Journal for the sixth year in a row. Visit markspaneth.com. It's 48 minutes past the hour, now time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Barry Ritholtz, a columnist for Bloomberg View. The way we measure productivity hasn't kept up with modern technology. As a result, economists regularly underestimate productivity gains. This is only going to get worse as the sharing economy becomes more widely adopted. Sharing technology makes unproductive assets, from spare rooms to unused equipment to parked cars, into productive revenue generators. The impact of such firms as Uber and Airbnb and hundreds of others of on-demand sharing apps simply isn't being captured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and their productivity models. These were designed for the heavy steel and iron companies of the 20th century. What happens as all these cars and spare rooms become significant revenue generators for more and more people? Without a revamp, the BLS models will continue to miss what is a key driver of economic growth. Robert Solow famously observed, "You could see the computer age everywhere but in the productivity statistics." This is a mistake which should be fixed. It's past due to bring productivity measures into the 21st century. I'm Barry Ritholtz, a columnist for Bloomberg View. For more Bloomberg opinion and commentary, please go to BloombergView.com or View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Thank you, Barry. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Steve Potas on KMOX in St. Louis. I'm reporting on Johnson & Johnson looking to move further talcum powder lawsuits out of St. Louis.
I'm Patrice Sikora, and for WTKK in Raleigh, I'm reporting on Sempra and the FDA panel that's voted in favor of its pneumonia drug that's shown effectiveness against drug-resistant bacteria.
I'm Ed Corey. On WWJ in Detroit, I'm talking about a report claiming U.S. testers have found software to cheat air quality tests in Audi cars this summer.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on WHAS in Louisville, home of Appliance Park. I'm reporting that Samsung is recalling about 2.8 million washing machines.
I'm Gina Cervetti, and on WFLA in Orlando, I'm reporting that Hard Rock Cafe International is prepared to make a major investment in Japan.
I'm Larry Komsky, and on Bloomberg 99.1 in Washington, I'm reporting on the latest emissions-related troubles for Volkswagen.
Thanks, Larry. We conclude tonight's show with a conversation with Alan Greenspan. He served as Federal Reserve Chairman under four different presidents from 1987 to 2006. Now, Greenspan spoke earlier with Tom Keene and David Gura on Bloomberg Surveillance.
I wonder the degree to which the Fed is paying attention to markets, the degree to which it's paid attention to the markets when you were helming it and it is now. How aware is it of what's going on?
105%.
All the time, or you know, what causes them to pay particular attention?
Let me give you my usual pattern. I would go into the board the first thing in the morning. The first thing I would do is to see what the markets were doing, both in the United States and especially abroad, because obviously in Europe the markets have been open for 5 hours longer and try to judge what the consequences are to the American economy and to the American financial system and what type of adjustment would be required, if at all, and most of the times nothing. So that what we used to do is to monitor the markets very closely, but act very rarely hastily.
Do you think that kind of attention is being paid today and with the level of relative transparency we have now, the news conferences, the occasional interviews, the ton of speeches we have from Fed officials, is some of that lost?
Well, I don't think that the issue of how much transparency you have is that critical. It's what the content of the transparency is. Central bankers are no better than an average good economist in forecasting the economy. As a consequence of that, we are limited in our projections of what policy is apt to be by the limits of our knowledge. And in that context, you try to convey as much as will be useful to the economy. And where there is a long-term strategic position in place about where the Fed is going, to reinforce that.
Chairman, you know that language matters. You did that with your Age of Turbulence. I think Sebastian Mallaby captured the life and times of Alan Greenspan quite nicely in his book. We just spoke with Sebastian about the man who knew. Alan Greenspan, what has changed is the language. We now have forward guidance, data dependency, and evidence. I know you don't speak about present monetary policy of any central bank, but can you define for us this new word, evidence? What does evidence mean to Alan Greenspan?
Evidence means the same thing it means in a court. Facts and whether or not they are valid. And that's as much as I can say on the issue, unless you want me to get into detailed econometrics.
Well, the detailed econometrics is making forward guesstimates and plugging in beliefs forward and judging from that. Do we need to move back to a more rules-based set of evidences, or is discretion the better choice right now?
Well, I've argued over the years that we have to do discretion, largely because any fixed paradigm doesn't seem to work very well. You run into very difficult problems and the system breaks down. So you have no choice but to use the discretion of the Federal Open Market Committee and its best judgment. The one thing that I think is important is not to communicate to the markets seemingly more than you know, because the market will come up and bite you, so to speak. So it's a very, the one thing I learned at the Federal Reserve as the years went on is that there's an extraordinary amount of just plain analytical, simple work of judging how the economy is going. And the best central banking is really determined by the best economic forecasting. So I would say that central banking starts with economic forecasting, which essentially means have a global view of how the system works and what it is likely to do if the Fed moves in one direction or the other. And once you've set that in place, you're basically using your state of knowledge of forecasting to translate it into monetary policy.
A question here about the institution. On the campaign trail, its independence, its integrity has been called into doubt by at least one of the candidates. Does the Fed need to do more to stand up for itself? In other words, is it at risk here of losing control of the narrative? If it's becoming a political punching bag, does that damage the institution?
It does, but it's not up to the Federal Reserve to cure that. It's up to the general political system which put the Fed in place. Remember that the Federal Reserve governors were given 14-year terms Why? To insulate them from short-term political considerations. And the way the Fed was set up originally in 1913 and started in 1914 was basically a series of things which tried to blunt the relationship between monetary policy and the average view of everybody. You cannot take a survey of the whole of the population to determine what they would like to be the monetary policy. You have to have expertise like you need expertise in economic forecasting. Mm. There is no substitute for that.
That was former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan speaking earlier with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and David Gura. And that's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. Our show is produced by David Sucherman and Richard Truman. I'm Ed Baxter. This is Bloomberg.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.